All right, into it. Today is November 17th, 2015. My name is Greg Bond. I'm at the University of Wisconsin Archives in Madison, Wisconsin, talking on the phone with Earl Hill, graduated from UW in 1959, I believe. And we're going to talk about his, do an oral history about his career as a student athlete in high school at Wisconsin and then his subsequent business career. And Earl, I think a good place to start, if you could just give us a little history of your parents, your mother and father, a little bit of their story.
Sure. Both of my parents grew up in Virginia, very, very small rural towns in Virginia, and they were not the benefactors of much education. Fortunately, my mother recognized the value of it and insisted that I do well in school, which laid the foundation academically for me.
Mm-hmm.
My dad, I did not see a lot of him because his working hours were such that I didn't see a whole lot of it, but any days that I got off vacation-wise during the summer, I spent as much time with him as I could.
And what did your father do?
He worked in a ice plant in Yonkers, New York, that manufactured ice.
Okay.
And in order to visit with him, when I was off school, I had to take a couple of buses and a trolley. But I always looked forward to it because it was a little bit of an adventure.
And when did your parents move to New York?
I'm not exactly certain.
Okay.
I am the eighth of nine children.
Wow.
And happened to be the first boy, by the way. My brother Robert deceased a few years ago. Mm. And I do believe my oldest two sisters were born in Virginia, and my parents moved north to New Rochelle. I'm going to guess sometime in the early 30s.
Okay. And so you were born in New Rochelle in, I think, 1937 or thereabouts?
That is correct.
And you grew up in New Rochelle?
Grew up in New Rochelle. Spent the first 17 years of my life there.
Okay. When did you start playing sports? Where did you pick up sports as a young kid?
I did. I was befriended by a guy who was several years older than me, and he sort of took me under his wing. He was my mentor,
mm-hmm.
And the downside of that was trying to play with he and his peers. And I got the worst part of it for several years.
Mm-hmm.
The good part of it is when he graduated to high school and kind of left me on my own, I was in pretty good shape with my peers.
Yes, yes, that's. I grew up playing with sports with my older brother, which I think had a sort of similar effect. You get better quickly when you have to. And what was it like growing up in New Rochelle? This would have been, I guess, the late 40s, after World War II, late 40s, early 50s, when you were a teenager.
It was great. I can't really recall any negative aspects of growing up in New Rochelle.
Okay.
I grew up in a section called City Park. There were lots of kids. They were all interested in sports. We all went to the same grammar school. We all went to the same junior high school, and of course, matriculated to New Rochelle High School.
Mm-hmm.
So many of the kids that I grew up with, we went through the entire school system together.
Okay. What was the composition of the town like? Were there lots of other African Americans around?
There wasn't a preponderance of them. I would guess. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 15%.
Okay. And then, so at New Rochelle High School, it seems like you were quite the athlete. You played three sports, football, basketball, and baseball. Any good memories of your high school sports career?
Yeah, I had fond memories. I thought when I was in junior high school and just prior to that, I thought my sport was going to be baseball. I played baseball every single day. In the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And thought I'd gotten pretty good at it, but something happened when I got to high school, and all of a sudden I enjoyed running into people and hitting people. Plus, quite frankly, I always desired to go to school. In fact, my fond desire was to go to a Big Ten school and play football.
Mm-hmm.
And my thinking was that the only way athletically to do that was going to be through football.
Sure. Did you, I guess growing up in the New York area, did you have a favorite baseball team, any favorite baseball player when you were more into baseball?
Yeah, I was a big fan of Willie Mays.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Most of my friends were big Dodger fans.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier in 1947. But
sure.
For some reason or other, I grew up a Yankee fan. I'm not anymore, but I
Well, that's good. It's good to see you recover from your mistakes as a youngster. I'm not a Yankees fan myself, but you also played basketball in high school. What position did you play in basketball?
I was a forward, and our best year was my senior year. We were within a few points of going undefeated, but we wound up losing a couple of games to two different teams that we met in the state championships, and it was a totally different story. We lost each game by 2 points.
Hmm.
We won by a lot more than that.
And I see here that you were elected captain of a couple teams in high school.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to be elected captain of the football, basketball, and baseball.
Oh, wow, all three. And how did that make you feel, being elected captain of all three sports?
You know, it's kind of hard to recall. I do know that it set a tone in my mind that I had to behave like a captain. I had to be set an example for the rest of the guys as I could.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What about other activities in high school? Did you do anything besides playing sports?
Frankly, Greg, I didn't have a whole lot of time to do anything else.
I can imagine so. Playing three sports takes up a lot of time.
What would happen was that the football season ran right into the basketball season. So after my last football game, the very next day, I was going to basketball practice.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with baseball.
Sure. This brings a question to mind. What did you do in the summers in high school? Did you have a job? Did you work at all?
I did odds and ends.
Okay.
Played summer baseball. We had a pretty good summer baseball league in New Rochelle. I played baseball during the summer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then you graduated from New Rochelle in 1955. You said earlier you were really interested in going to a Big Ten school from early on. Were you recruited heavily when you were a senior in high school?
Not really.
Okay.
My real aspiration was to go to University of Pennsylvania Wharton School of Business,
mm-hmm.
get a degree in accounting.
Mm-hmm.
And deep down in my heart, however, the Big Ten was calling me.
Okay. Did you look at other Big Ten schools?
I did not.
Okay. What brought you to Wisconsin?
Well, there was, interestingly enough, that article that you sent me kind mm-hmm. of pointed it out more specifically. There was a guy by the name of Steve Keenan that I went through the entire school system in New Rochelle from kindergarten to high school.
Mm-hmm.
And both of us had experienced Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts. And Steve's dad happened to be our Boy Scout then father, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And my senior year at New Rochelle, he approached me and said, and it was pretty late in the year, too, quite frankly, had I decided where I was going to school. And I had visited Syracuse and had been offered a full scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, I've just about made up my mind. And he said the magic words. He said, have you ever considered Wisconsin? Well, the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As soon as he said Wisconsin, it was all over.
And Steve's father was involved with the Alumni Association, I think I read. Does that sound right?
Yes, he was the president of the Alumni Association.
So
timing is everything.
Yes, and a good friend to have, certainly. I understand your high school coach also had some ties to Wisconsin. Lou Amundson?
Yeah, Lou Amundson was from
Amundson. Okay. So you come to Wisconsin in, I guess, would have been 55 as your freshman year. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about coming to Wisconsin, coming to Madison, the transition from maybe the East Coast to the Midwest, from New Rochelle to Madison, and maybe also your freshman year played in the freshman football team, and your sophomore year you made the varsity but didn't play a lot. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your first couple years of Madison, your memories of coming to Madison, getting used to Wisconsin and Madison and the Big Ten.
Okay. I'll first talk about the transition academically.
Okay.
It should not have been challenging to me, but it was.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot the basics. I didn't forget them. I sort of overlooked them and consequently did not have a very good first semester as a freshman.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told in no uncertain terms by Milt Bruin, the head coach,
mm-hmm.
if I didn't do a lot better second semester as a freshman, I might be going home.
Mm.
But that was a wake-up call.
That lit a fire under you?
It sure did. Because my thinking was there was no way I could ever go back to New Rochelle.
Mm-hmm.
Failure. Never.
Mm-hmm.
And so I settled in. From a football standpoint, it was quite an awakening in that, gosh, there were over 100 freshman players, and all of them were on some kind of scholarship.
Yep.
And all of them were from all state, all county, or all something.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of daunting. It caused me to pause and think, gee, are you going to be able to make it here? And there was a little bit of doubt that crept in my mind. But
mm-hmm.
I reverted back to what I said about academically making it.
Sure.
I cannot fail. I can't.
Mm-hmm. So that sounds like after your first semester or so here, first year here, you just redoubled down on the hard work both in the classroom and on the football field to make sure you succeeded.
Exactly.
Okay. How about your first year in the varsity? I think that would have been 1956. You didn't play a whole lot, but what was it like to be on the varsity and to experience big time Big Ten football for the first time as a varsity player?
Well, it was quite an experience. Quite an enjoyable experience. Quite a daunting experience. I think it was the latter part of the season. Guy who was playing in front of me. I was a second string right end.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy in front of me, Dave Howard, got hurt just before halftime in the Illinois game.
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up playing the entire second half of the Illinois game, which gave me a significant amount of experience.
Mm-hmm.
It made me finally feel like, hey, you belong here and you're going to make it. You're going to do well. It's just a question of how well.
Mm-hmm. It's always good to get experience like that early on. One thing that happens after your sophomore year in 1956, of course, is the incident with LSU. Wisconsin signs a football contract home and away with Louisiana State University, but LSU stipulates that Wisconsin can't bring any African-American players to play against them in Louisiana. That transpires over the summer of 1956. Were you around campus that summer? Do you remember people talking about that very much?
No, I was not on campus. I was back home in New Rochelle.
Okay.
Quite matter-of-factly, Ray, I did not know anything about that controversy until long after I had graduated.
Really?
Apparently, Ivy Williamson handled that immaculately because I never heard a word about it.
Really? That's very interesting. So the players weren't talking about it. No one from the athletic department said anything about that when you returned to campus?
No. When we returned to campus, There had been a change in the schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of playing LSU in 57, 56, whatever it was, we had West Virginia was coming to Madison.
Mm-hmm.
And the second year of that home-and-home series, we went down to Miami.
Okay, that's right.
That was all that really I was aware of. I never heard of the controversy with LSU.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. I know, during having done some research on this, in the summer there's a lot of stuff in the newspapers, and the athletic department did seem to handle it very quickly. They very quickly said, this is unacceptable, we won't agree to this, and got out of the contract. And it's interesting that it wasn't talked about a lot. Do you, looking back on it, does it surprise you that it wasn't talked about it more, that no one made a bigger issue of it at the time?
Not really. Couple of things. Number one, my teammate, my roommate for much of my college career, and to this very day, my best friend, Sid Williams, grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home with Sid in the spring of 56.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Little Rock, and of course, it was very segregated.
Yes.
It was a real eye-opener to me, and made me appreciate Sidney even more and respect him even more growing up in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming out to Madison.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect, had I known about it, I'm not so sure of what it would have motivated me a little bit more even.
Mm-hmm.
To know that somebody was rejecting me and my fellow African American players solely on the basis of the pigmentation of our skin,
mm-hmm.
I think that would have motivated me. I almost said something that I should have said about color, but I think it would have motivated me.
Okay, that certainly makes sense to me. Since you brought up Sidney Williams, I'd be interested to hear more about your relationship with Sidney Williams. He was on campus, I think, a year or two before you got here. And then I think during your sophomore year became the starting quarterback late in the year. How did you meet Sidney Williams? How did you become friends with him? What was your relationship with him like?
We met because we were staying in the same dorm. We were staying in the university YMCA.
Mm-hmm.
On Brook Street.
Okay.
To house most of the athletes at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, we just sort of gravitated together. I do know that there were some instances where the coach mistook Sidney for me and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Twice. But we just kind of, we just had a lot of things in common.
Mm-hmm.
That had significant impact. We had both been significantly impacted by our moms.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a neat guy, a guy I enjoyed being around, a guy who I had a tremendous amount of respect for. And once I started rooming with him and seeing what it took to become a chemical engineer, which what he was studying, I said, my God. There just isn't any way I could have done that.
Yeah, I couldn't do that either. That is certainly out of my wheelhouse. Where did you, when you roomed with Sidney Williams, was that also at the YMCA, or did you live elsewhere?
We had an apartment on campus, right off University Avenue.
Okay. You talked about a little bit earlier, Sidney Williams growing up in Little Rock, you growing up in New Rochelle in the north, the very different perspectives, very different kinds of atmospheres that those places had in the 50s. Do you remember talking at all about what's going on in Little Rock, the early civil rights movement in the 50s, with Sidney Williams when you're on campus?
We did not talk about that. We did talk about Sidney growing up in Little Rock when mm-hmm. we went down to visit. We went down for spring break, and I was there for about 5 or 6 days.
Okay.
And so I got a real good taste of the environment he grew up in. Met one of his best buddies who he played with in high school, who happened to go on to be a star at the University of Michigan. His name was Jim Pace.
Sure.
And he happened to be there at the time, and met him, and the three of us spent quite a bit of time together. But no, we didn't talk about the demonstrations or anything like that.
When you visited Little Rock with Sydney, was that the first time you had really gone south to experience the legal Jim Crow there in person?
The very first time.
Okay.
Prior to that, I don't think I had been south of Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And quite frankly, growing up in New York, I had images of all of the stereotypes that I had grown up around and heard and seen.
What kind of stereotypes do you mean?
It was not beneficial to be a black man.
Sure, of course. How did, you said this was really an eye-opening experience for you. Do you remember, it's interesting, this is your first, introduction to the Southern style of race relations. Do you remember other reactions you had to it? Were you determined not to go back to the South after that? Do you remember any other reactions you might have had to this experience? Okay.
I just hadn't been.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there, subsequent to graduating, yes, there were a few instances.
Okay. I certainly hope to explore that in a little bit, but let's stick it with Wisconsin for now. So junior year is your big breakout year. You're the starting right end, I believe it is. You score two touchdowns. You're the second leading receiver on the team. Actually, one interesting thing I saw in the football stats for that year, you actually logged the most minutes on the field of anyone in the team that year. So interested to hear you talk about that a little bit. Your junior year, your big breakout year, leading receiver. What was that like? Do you remember feeling?
Well, I'll go back to the summer leading up to.
Okay.
I knew I was going to be a starter, and barring a crippling injury, I had two more years as a starter.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked my butt off that summer to get in the best shape I could get in.
Okay.
And when I came back, I was one of the few guys who, during early fall practice, the two-a-days,
mm-hmm.
was gaining weight instead of losing.
Oh, wow.
They thought I was some kind of freak. how I wound up playing the most minutes was... The other end, the other starter, Dave Kucerik, got hurt just before the Michigan State game.
Mm-hmm.
And although we had two deep, what it meant was we only had three guys to take care of the entire game. And I wanted to play the whole game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you remember your two touchdown catches from that year?
I don't.
Okay.
I really don't.
I meant to look them up in the box score, and I forgot which games they were. I guess the next obvious question is your senior year, you come back, you're the starter again, you're the third leading receiver. One of the interesting things you referenced earlier, senior year, the first game you traveled to Miami to play University of Miami in the Orange Bowl, traveling south in the late 50s is, of course, sometimes a tricky proposition for African Americans and for integrated teams. Do you remember anything about that trip to Miami standing out?
Oh, very definitely so. We played a Friday night game.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to stay over until Sunday, so we had all day Saturday and Saturday night,
mm-hmm.
kind of hang out on our own,
sure.
if you will. And I can still vividly remember picking up the paper, the Miami Herald,
mm-hmm.
and looking in the sports section. And both Sid and I were together. We were kind of inseparable. And we're reading about the game the previous night, and there was a little article towards the back end of the sports section talking about there had been several hundred black attendees turned away from the Orange Bowl because the section in the Orange Bowl devoted to the blacks was filled,
mm-hmm.
so they turned them away.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in spite of the fact that the game was not a sellout. And we looked at each other and we you talking about biting your nose, it cut off your face. I mean, it was crazy. And then it kind of set in even more. We said, wow, it may have been a much different game had we known about that last night.
Sure. Yeah, it's those internal logic of the segregation that never really seems to make sense if you think about it. Turning away paying customers just because that section is full, that certainly is a product of the times, and it's a very interesting story. Anything else from that trip stand out?
The other thing to conclude the story, I was just
sorry about that.
Prior to the game, Sydney had got quite a bit of billing as the first black quarterback coming to Miami to play for a major team, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that's why the black section was sold out. They came primarily because Sydney was playing quarterback. We had some other black players.
Mm-hmm.
And to think that they would turn away spectators for that reason, I think that would have been a major motivating factor.
Sure.
At least for me, because at the risk of sounding a little harsh, growing up in New York, you didn't stand for any of that. You really didn't. If someone made any overtures in a negative fashion about you, it could lead to something that they or you didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm. Did you have experience like that in New York? Going back to New Rochelle a little bit, were there incidents like that you remember?
I do not. I remember as a young boy, and I don't know the particulars. One of my friends who I played with quite a bit, he happened to be Italian heritage.
Mm-hmm.
Called me the N-word one day and got into a scuffle. And the understanding from that point on was, you don't ever call me that word.
Mm-hmm.
And I will pay homage to your Italian heritage by not calling you any words of a negative fashion.
Sure.
And we'll be good friends. But if you use that N-word, we're going to be out here in the dust. Back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a great story. Getting back to, you mentioned Sidney Williams, one of the first starting African-American quarterbacks for a Big Ten school, for a big university. Do you remember other people making a big deal of that besides before this trip to Miami, how this is sort of an unusual thing that was happening?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
You guys, keep in mind as we talk, I had gone to the University of Wisconsin-Madison first and foremost to get a degree.
Sure.
That was the most important thing in my life.
Mm-hmm.
The football was just icing on the cake, and it was a tremendous experience and set the stage for me to do a lot more things later on in my life.
Sure.
But as I'm going through that, you really didn't pay much attention to those kinds of things.
Okay.
In the first or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. It's looking back, it sometimes seems more memorable than perhaps it was the time, because people living through it are focused on these other things like you're talking about. It's interesting perspective, retrospective versus living it at the time. You talked a lot about Sidney Williams. Did you have good relationships with other players in the team?
I did. I absolutely did. I didn't have any problems or run into any negative situations with any of the players.
Okay.
Now, having said that, sometimes in the heat of the battle in practice, did we get into some scuffles? You betcha.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about your relationship with Coach Milt Bruin and the assistant coaches and the rest of the athletic department staff? Was that a good relationship?
It was. The best relationship I had by far was with my position coach, mm-hmm. Paul Shaw.
Okay.
He was an amazing man. I still remember to this day, getting ready to play someone, and I can't recall who it was, and he was the coach that had scouted that team the week before.
Mm-hmm.
And during the course of the week leading up to that game at practice, he was giving us little tidbits, giving us little cues. If you're on defense and the guy playing in front of you does this, you can anticipate this happening.
Sure.
And sure enough, early in the game, one of the keys that he had shared with us, occurred, and I did what I was supposed to do and wound up throwing the ball carrier about 8 yards long. And, you know, just read. I already had a tremendous amount of admiration and respect. It was just reinforced that.
Mm-hmm.
He really knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. Another question that might not have stuck out at you at the time, that in retrospect seems like an important incident. At the end of your senior year, or actually at the end of the football season, the UW basketball team goes to Houston to play a basketball game, and the two black players in the team, Jim Biggs and Ivan Jefferson, are not allowed to stay with the rest of the team in Houston. They have to stay at a historically black college in Houston during this trip, and when they come back, the athletic board passes a new policy saying that athletic teams from Wisconsin can no longer accept segregated accommodations. Do you remember that at all from being on campus in 1958?
I do not.
Okay. Okay.
Absolutely do not. And I knew both of those guys very well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We hung out together with some of the football players.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall an incident.
Okay. Okay. So that leads me to another question I had. You did have relationships with athletes in other sports. It wasn't just football players you knew and hung out with from the athletic department.
That's correct. Jimmy Biggs, Ivan Jefferson, Jesse Nixon was on the track team.
Yep.
My very first roommate, my freshman year, was a guy by the name of Dick Estick. He was a track, ran track. Yeah, there were other athletes that we hung out with, sure.
Okay. And before, I guess, backtracking a little bit before we leave the football career, of course, in the 50s is before the two platoon system, so you're playing both offense and defense, and you're also one of the team's main punters for your last 2 years. Just interested to hear you talk a little bit about playing defense and then doing some punting, if you have any memories about those activities in the field.
I do. It's funny you should ask that question. I just talked to Sid last week, I believe it was. We were kind of reminiscing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sharing with him the fact that when I first came to Wisconsin, I had visions of being Elroy Hirsch reincarnated,
sure.
Catching all kinds of touchdown passes, et cetera. And lo and behold, the offense there was 3 yards in a cloud of dust.
Still that way many times.
Yes, it is. And having said that, because we were required to play defense,
mm-hmm.
I grew to really, really enjoy playing defense.
Okay.
I was kind of the notion, give them the ball and let's see what they can do with it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll wind up somewhere and somehow I'll get enough points to win the game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how'd you get into being a punter? Just good at it?
Punted in high school.
Oh, okay.
Punted in high school.
Okay. I guess one last question about football. You said you had good relationships with the players in your team, but you mentioned the heat of the battle in practice sometimes or some scuffles. Do you remember any problems with players and opposing teams in your career at UW, maybe saying something inappropriate or not liking playing against you, or did things go rather smoothly on the field?
Never.
Okay. So, any other memorable events of the Badger you wanna talk about before we move on to the academics at UW?
I can't think of any. If I do, I'll sure share them with you.
Okay, yeah, certainly no problem jumping around a little bit. So you were in the School of Commerce here at UW, is that correct?
Yes.
And you were an accounting major?
Yes.
And you said earlier that your first semester didn't go perhaps as well as you would have liked it to go, but I'd like to hear a little bit about the rest of your academic career at Wisconsin. What was the School of Commerce like? What was how did you feel in the classroom?
After that first semester, as I said, I settled back in and did the things I knew I was supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
and didn't encounter any more difficulties. At that time, you could declare what your major would be when you enrolled as a freshman, but your first 2 years were taking college courses.
Sure.
So I didn't enter the School of Commerce until my junior year.
Okay.
it's kind of ironic now, and here's what I attribute to my tunnel vision, if you will. It dawned on me, again, quite a few years after I graduated, I was the only African American in the entire school conference.
Hmm. But that caused no problems for you or anything?
I never thought about that going through school.
Huh. That's very interesting. Any memorable professors stand out to you in looking back at your time in the classroom?
Yes, but I can't recall their names. I had a business ethics professor who wore a bow tie all the time. And, he was a taskmaster. My goodness, he was tough. But I managed to survive.
Excellent. I think I saw you were a member of Alpha Phi Alpha when you were on campus.
Yes.
I'd be interested to hear you talk about that a little bit. This is a historically African-American fraternity. Was this the base of your social life when you were in Madison, around the fraternity?
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
Let me give you the background of that story. We had a very active social life.
Okay.
All of the other black athletes that I hung around with, we really enjoyed that aspect of our college life.
Mm-hmm.
However, there was this thing going on called fraternity intramurals.
Sure.
Track and field, basketball, that because we weren't in a fraternity, we could participate.
Huh.
And there were a lot of football players on the involved in those, a lot of our teammates.
Sure.
Specifically basketball. So it dawned upon us, we had about four or five guys, all of us were all-state basketball players.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we didn't have this venue to really participate in. So secondly, the other point was, that was an avenue that was unavailable to black athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Fraternity.
Yep.
And so there were a couple of grad students who were going to Madison at the time who were alphas. And they said, look, we will sponsor you if some of you guys pledge and go through that ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sidney and I and Jesse Nixon and a track team,
mm-hmm.
three of us, pledged.
Hmm.
And we went through and we survived. We survived with a warning and two along the way, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the Alpha chapter in Madison got started.
Hmm. That's a very interesting story. Talking about your social life in Madison, you hung out with other black athletes a lot, you were saying. Madison sometimes has a reputation of not always being friendly to people of color. Did you get that sense when you were here in the 50s that the town wasn't always very welcoming to African Americans?
I did not.
Okay.
But part of my story I should relate to you is my freshman year, I got introduced to a young lady, a local.
Mm-hmm.
And we dated for my entire career at UW,
mm-hmm.
and subsequently got married.
Okay.
So that was a great part. That was a great deal of my social life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in terms of any incident, the very first incident, and the only incident I can recall in Madison, was after I had graduated, and my wife at the time, the young lady who was local,
mm-hmm.
was looking for an apartment. And I decided that whenever I call an ad seeking an apartment, I would tell them, I would ask them, do you rent to blacks?
Mm-hmm.
And I got a couple of phones hung up in my ear.
Sure.
I got a couple of absolutely not. And I got one or two, no way on God's green earth.
Hmm.
And it really took me, and I said, this is Madison.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's the experience for many people over the years in Madison. It's not as welcoming as perhaps we like to think it is to everyone. But you eventually did find an apartment to rent?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And shortly after that, moved to Chicago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you graduated in 1959, I believe. What did you do after you graduated?
I graduated in 60.
60, okay.
My fourth year of eligibility was 1958.
Mm-hmm.
And so 59, I went back to school. No, actually, I didn't go back to school. I had about 10 to 12 credits.
Okay.
Prior to graduate.
Sure.
And what happened was that leads to this other part that you want to talk about after Wisconsin. I signed with the Cardinals as a free agent.
Mm-hmm. And when was that?
That was in 59.
Okay, so right after your final year of football at UW.
Yes. And went down to their camp in Lake Forest, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Lake Forest College. And I think I lasted about 2.5-3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I got cut, went back to Madison to join my wife, who was pregnant with our first child.
Mm-hmm.
And about no more than 2 or 3 days after I returned to Madison, I get this phone call from British Columbia, Canada. Who the hell is this? And the Chicago Cardinals had a working relationship with the BC Lions and
sure.
Indian football league.
Mm-hmm.
And they were calling me, and they came, they learned I just because they wanted me to come out there. So they sent me a plane ticket, and off I went. And it was a very interesting experience in that they only were allowed to keep 12 Americans on their active roster.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was on the roster, off the roster, on the roster, off the roster, depending upon the injury situation.
Sure.
And finally I said, enough of this. I'm going home. And I thanked them for the experience, and I went back next.
So how long were you up from British Columbia, about?
It was about 3 weeks, and a half weeks.
Okay. Did you get any games when you were there?
No, I did not.
Okay.
In one single minute of playing time.
I'd be curious to hear you talk a little bit more about the training camp for the Chicago Cardinals. What was that like? Was that, again, like you went to college, it's just winnowing down the field a little more, everyone there is still really good, and it's an eye-opening experience kind of thing?
Well, that was the beginning of my education in race relations.
Okay.
And in real race relations.
Mm-hmm.
Six other free agents, and they were all African American.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all cut, not at the same time, but none of us made it.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me once I got down there, and we talked about it, we meaning the six African American rookies. You looked at the Chicago Cardinals roster, and 75% of the players are from the Southeast.
Mm.
Auburn, Mississippi,
sure.
Mississippi State. All of the coaches were from the South.
Hmm.
And we said, isn't this interesting?
Quite the coincidence, to be sure.
Oh, and by the way, that summer, right after I had signed, in that time frame,
mm-hmm.
The Cardinals had just traded the one guy who they really had was good, Ollie Mattson. They traded him to the Los Angeles Rams for 8 players.
Wow.
It was a 1-for-8 trade. And there was, I don't have any basis or knowledge to prove this, but the rumor was Ollie had kind of demanded to be traded because, number one, you weren't winning, and number two, he wasn't being treated as well as he thought he should.
Sure. That's, again, an interesting story, certainly a product of the times. You played a little bit, semi-pro football in Chicago a couple years after graduating, the Chicago Panthers?
Yes, I did.
What was the Central States Football League? What was that league like?
It had some good players. Some plays, former players from the Big Ten.
Mm-hmm.
We had teams in Wisconsin. It was a Racine, team from Racine. I believe there was one or two from Indiana, like the East Chicago, Gary area. And, of course, I think the rest of them from Illinois.
Sure.
It was fun. The pay was lousy. And what finally dawned on me is by then I had become a father.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working temporarily with the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And the semi-pro football league did not provide any health insurance. I said, this is crazy.
Yes, sounds so.
And I saw guys getting hurt, and, you know, we didn't have much insurance. So I said, no, this doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I fully retired from football.
Sounds like a prudent decision for a young father. So you're retired. You said you're working for the federal government for a little bit. What were you doing for the government?
I was working for the Social Security Administration as a, they call them claims rep. Accepted retirement and disability benefit applications.
Mm-hmm. And this was in Chicago?
Yeah.
And then I think your longest career is working with IBM. Is that correct?
I would think so. 25 years.
Yeah. How did you get that job?
While I was working for the Social Security Administration, a friend of mine called me one evening at home. He was excited as he could be. And he said, I just accepted this job. I said, really? In fact, he worked for a different agency of the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah, who would? He said, IBM, as a salesman. And I said, what? He said, yeah. And they're still looking for African-Americans. It's groundbreaking time. And you'd be a perfect candidate. So I went down to the local IBM office in Chicago and applied for the job. I went through a battery of interviews. I think I must have interviewed with four or five different people.
Mm-hmm.
Took some personality tests, whatever. And they got back to me and they said, you are a very, very acceptable candidate. We want to hire you. I said, great. which office here? And they said, oh, no, not here. They said, we will give you the choice of Denver, Kansas City, or St. Louis. Translated, there were no black salesmen in Denver, Kansas City, or St. Louis.
Sure.
So I had a friend who also had worked, was working for Social Security from Kansas City. We had gone through this training session together.
Mm-hmm.
And so and my wife at the time had an aunt who lived in Kansas City. And so Kansas City was a natural choice.
Okay.
Went to work for them.
And how do you like your new job as a salesman?
I loved it. It required some of the lessons I think I had learned along the way in Madison, and
mm-hmm.
that there was nobody looking over my shoulder telling me I had to go out and make those sales calls every day.
Mm-hmm.
You just had to summon up the discipline to do that.
Sure.
Do it in the face of many, many no's.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoy it. I truly enjoy it.
And what were you selling? Were you selling mainframes or what's IBM making in the 60s?
I was in the office products division.
Oh, office products, so, okay.
Yeah, I sold typewriters and dictation equipment.
Okay. And for how many years were you a salesman for IBM?
5 years.
Okay. And then what happens?
I got an opportunity to transition into a career that was more closely aligned with my degree from the School of Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
Madison. And by the way, I had majored in accounting there, but my degree was in business administration.
Okay.
General
degree.
And there was an opportunity that came up in HR, personnel at IBM. And it turned out to be the job that has really shaped me and molded me personally, professionally, and otherwise.
I'd love to hear more about that. What kind of things were you doing for HR? Why do you think it was so meaningful for you? I'd love to hear some more about that.
Okay, the job, the initial job in personnel, HR, number one, brought me to Atlanta. And I still remember I had been seeking this particular job for months. And I had a message out in the territory. I was out in the territory to call the office. And there was a message from my sales manager wanting to meet me after work. So I went in and he said, "Oh, I got great news. We found that job that we've been looking for." I said, "Great, where is it?" And I was anticipating New York, Chicago, or LA. I didn't know they had a job. I didn't know they had an office in Atlanta. And he said, "No, it's in Atlanta." And I said, "You mean like in Georgia?" And he said, "Yes." And I thought, and my mom had always taught me, never say never, never say always. Give it a shot. Always say no later on.
Yep.
So I flew down to Atlanta for the interview. The guy who interviewed me, he was the manager of the office. Became a very, very close personal friend and confidant and mentor. He was from St. Paul, Minnesota. He had five guys reporting to him, and four of the five were Yankees, if you will. And I talked to each of those five guys, and the last guy, the fifth guy I talked to, was from Pennsylvania, and he had been a football player at Penn State.
Okay.
And I still remember walking into his office. His name is Jim Kerr. I walk into his office. He closes the door, and as he's sitting down, he says, "Earl, let me just get to the bottom line. If you don't take this job, you're an F fool." The job was a corporate recruiter.
Okay.
I represented IBM on about 12 or 15 campuses in the Southeast.
Okay.
Coordinating IBM's recruiting effort.
And
what it meant is I was traveling 90% of the time. I was on the college campuses. I was meeting all kinds of people from other facilities in IBM.
Sure.
Came in just to get the interviews. So it was a truly, truly life-altering experience. And I loved it.
Excellent.
Really.
So one question that comes to mind, you talked about sort of being a groundbreaker at IBM is what your friend said. Your first couple years at IBM, this would have been, I guess, in the throughout this, the mid-60s, late-60s. What was the atmosphere like at IBM? Did you feel welcome? Did you feel like everyone was supporting you when you were at IBM?
Yes, I started in 63.
Okay.
My understanding from reliable sources was the Office Products Division was the very first division in IBM that hired blacks into the sales force. And this was motivated by the relationship that the then CEO, Thomas Watson Jr., had with John F. Kennedy.
Okay.
Apparently they were very close friends. And, I don't know the circumstances, but they were in a conversation one day, and Watson said, "You know, we really need to do something about diversifying our sales force." And Kennedy had put forth this plan for progress for the entire country. And so Watson kind of hitchhiked on that. OP was designated as the division to make that happen, and he did. I did not encounter any difficulties within IBM. But being in Kansas City, I sure as hell ran into a couple of instances outside of IBM.
Sure. So Kansas City in the mid-60s was not the friendliest place all the time.
No, it was not. I remember one specific incident where I went into a particular office that I had just acquired a new territory in.
Mm-hmm.
That office was in a new territory, and I walked in and gave the secretary my card, indicated whom I wanted to see, and she went into the office, his office, I assume, and came back out. He can't see it. I said, well, let me leave my card, and would you please have him call me so that we can arrange an appointment?
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, that particular call that I was making on that particular customer was an accounts receivable call.
Sure.
They owed us money. They had paid.
Mm-hmm.
Go and find out what was wrong. I get back to the office that evening, and my branch manager called me, and he said, did you go to such and such account today? And I said, yeah, you know, it's one of my new accounts. They owe us some money, and I want to find out what the circumstances were.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why do you ask? He said, well, the guy that you wanted to meet called me right after you left the office. I said, oh, he did. He didn't meet with me, but he said, yeah, I know he didn't meet with you, but he called me. I said, what did he want? He said he wanted to tell me that he didn't want no niggers calling on him. I said, excuse me? And my branch manager said, yeah, that's what he called. And I said, well, what did you tell him? Thinking, this might be a very short career with the IBM Corp.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I told him that you were eminently qualified for the job. You'd been through the training like everybody else. And if he didn't want you to call on him, then he could take his business elsewhere.
Wow.
That was his statement. And I said, well, this company not only talks the talk, they apparently walk the walk.
Yeah, that's a great story. Very interesting. So you're in HR for how long at IBM? Sounds like 20 years or so?
Almost 20 years.
Okay.
About 20 years, yeah.
Were you traveling the whole time, or did you stop traveling at some point to college campuses?
Well, it's sort of a mixed up answer. I had a couple other traveling assignments.
Okay.
But I also moved around quite a bit.
Okay.
I started in Kansas City in sales. Like I said, I moved to Atlanta with a corporate recruiting job. From there, I went to New Jersey to Maryland back to Atlanta, Atlanta to Menlo Park, California, Menlo Park back to Maryland, and Maryland back to Atlanta.
Wow.
And as you probably can surmise, Atlanta had grown on me.
Yes.
I knew I'd wind up here.
Mm-hmm. Did all the moving around have any negative effects on you? Or did you think of each new assignment as a new challenge?
I obviously looked upon each new assignment as a new challenge. It's debatable whether or not it had any negative effect on my personal life. I did know that I got divorced in California.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was just curious, a lot of moving around. So when did you retire from IBM?
End of 1988.
Okay.
December 31st, 1988.
And was there a big retirement party for you?
Not a big one.
Okay.
About 10 to 12 people.
And is that when you got into teaching after you retired from IBM?
About a year and a half later. A professor at Emory, whom I had met when I was at IBM, he was involved in a couple of programs
mm-hmm.
that we were offering, called me home one evening, and he said, what are you doing these days? And I said, I'm doing some consulting. And he said, there was a job at the business school here at Emory that's perfectly suited to you. I've seen you in action in front of a group of managers, et cetera, and I know you do well.
Mm-hmm.
I categorically reject. said, well, I'm not interested. He said, well, think about it. I said, okay. Now I'll make this story short. He called me back about a week later. Thought about it. No, I haven't. Well, I said, okay, I promise I'll think about it. 10 days later, 2 weeks later, he calls back. I said, I still have not developed any interest whatsoever. He said, well, do one last favor for me. Meet with our department coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
Over here at Emory. Talk it over, and if you decide you don't want to do it, then I'll leave you alone. I said, fine. I went over, and that was in July, August of 91. And over a two-hour lunch, I said, well, it sounds interesting enough to give it a try.
Okay.
And here I am, approaching 25 years later, immensely enjoying.
Wow. What subjects are you teaching?
I finally focused on one, and that's the negotiations course.
Okay.
And I teach it at all levels, the undergrad, and the executive.
Mm-hmm. And before that, you taught other subjects as well?
Sort of HR subject.
Okay. And it sounds like you really enjoy the teaching.
I do. It has opened up some vistas that heretofore had not been available to me. And most notably, I developed a relationship in France, Finland, and Austria, whereby I was going over and teaching in those countries during the summer.
Wow.
And I did that for about 10 or 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, really neat.
What was it like teaching overseas?
It was great. Obviously, I taught in English because mm-hmm. I did not know any of the language. The students, obviously, know English. But for the most part, when I got out in the town away from the campuses, I was kind of on my own. That was a lot of fun.
Yes. Interesting adventures, I'm sure you had.
Yeah, I learned just enough of the local language to get by. And in one or two instances, I learned enough to get in trouble.
Yes, that's often the case when we're traveling. Anything else that sticks out that you want to talk about from your business career, your teaching career?
I can't think of it.
Okay. I guess we're about an hour now. I'll ask you a couple sort of reflection questions, thought questions before we wrap up. Have you been back to Madison or UW much since you graduated?
I have. There was a period of time from when I graduated up until mid-80s, that I didn't get back very often. In fact, I only went back once or twice.
Mm-hmm.
But then my new wife, my current wife,
mm-hmm.
surprised me on my birthday in 1985. And when I say surprise, she blew me away. Because she was an IBMer also. And
mm-hmm.
in the summer, she had worked with an intern from UW.
Okay.
And she said, of course, my husband went to UW, he played football, blah, blah, blah. And I've never been there. And so she and the intern, behind my back, got two tickets to the Ohio State football game.
Mm-hmm.
Got a reservation at the Edgewater. And purchased two plane tickets to Madison.
Nice.
And when she gave them to me, it was before my birthday because the game was right around. But
mm-hmm.
I can't keep the secret any longer. She gave me an envelope. And there were two tickets to Madison. I said, what's this for? And hold on. She gave me another envelope. And it was reservations at the Edgewater. And then when she gave me the two tickets to Ohio State, I got passed out. And ever since then, I've got back. Well, it was between 85 and 2000. I got back every 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I've got a daughter who lives in Madison.
Oh, cool.
She didn't go to UW, but mm-hmm. she graduated from high school there and went to work for a law firm and loves
looking back at your time at UW as a student or an athlete, how do you think it affected you? Do you have any, just sort of reflecting on that time, any advice for current student athletes, anything that you think your time as a student athlete really taught you? Just, I don't know, just any reflections on your time as a here at UW?
A couple of things. Obviously, you have to keep your nose to the grindstone academically.
Mm-hmm.
Like I mentioned a while ago,
sure.
I lost my way momentarily, but thank God I had the foundation to get back on track.
Mm-hmm.
So focus on the academics, and secondly, focus on relationships, because you heard me talk about Sid a lot.
Yep.
He's like a brother to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's mentioned vice versa, and we talk at least every few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
At least last summer he and his wife came through Atlanta, and they spent 4 or 5 days with my wife and I here.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had a marvelous time.
Excellent.
And I suspect that everybody should be afforded the opportunity to develop at least one relationship like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One that'll last a lifetime.
Sure, sure. No, it's no arguments here. Do you still follow sports at all?
I follow Badgers.
Okay, that's good.
Sometimes that's no good, but I follow them.
Well, they've done all right this year, Ben. I thought they might do, especially with Corey Clement being hurt. I was actually at that game. It was not the most fun game I've been at Camp Randall, unfortunately. It's been an interesting season, to be sure. Do you still follow the issue, or do you follow issues, sort of bigger issues surrounding college sports? There's a lot of talk about concussions in football now. There's some talk about sort of ongoing labor issues. There's just the incident at University of Missouri where the football team took a stand for what they thought were some important civil rights causes. You are interested in those kind of issues at all? Do you follow those types of stories?
Oh, I absolutely do. Absolutely do. As it relates to the injury situation, concussions, I talk about it not only with Sid, but with some of my other colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
And I said one of the more interesting aspects of that is when I was in Wisconsin, we were taught to lead blocking with our head.
Hmm.
With our head. Now, having said that, I said, I think the difference between then and now is these guys are so much bigger.
Yeah.
So much faster.
Mm-hmm.
So much stronger.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that. You simply can't.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall? Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, in 4 years, I can't recall more than two or three guys having concussions.
Okay.
In 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's actually what I was going to ask.
It's every game.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
And then as it relates to the labor thing, but yes, I sure as hell have been following that.
Actually, that combines your two interests, I suppose, business and sports.
Yes. There's a gross inequity that's taking place, I believe. First mm-hmm. of all, it is inconceivable to me that the football coach makes more money than the president of the university. That's
mm-hmm.
inconceivable.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that leads me to the conclusion that it's all about the money. Then you take a look at what the coaches pay and what the student athletes, at least that's what I still call them,
mm-hmm.
student athletes,
mm-hmm.
receive. They said, well, they get a college degree. How many of those guys actually graduate?
Yeah, that's a good question.
How many of them are going through some pretty tough times financially?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because they can't even accept a meal from somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are...
There's no guarantee that their scholarship will be in existence next year because if your performance falls off or you get injured or you get nicked up, well, thanks for the memories.
Do you have any thoughts on what might improve the situation?
One, and this is one that I've harbored for a long time. Go back to the days when I enrolled in Wisconsin and made all freshmen ineligible.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get on your feet academically for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Where you participate in varsity sports. I think that would help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen other people suggest that also. That would certainly at least make sure that the student-athletes have time to concentrate in their studies before they're thrown right into the big-time college sports. It's an interesting suggestion, to be sure. I've seen other people make it, and I think it should be something to think about. Any thoughts on what just happened to University of Missouri with the football team going on strike against the school president?
I have kind of reserved my thoughts. I've tried to reserve my thoughts.
Okay.
Because number one, I wasn't there.
Sure, sure.
Number two, I don't know what the president did or didn't do.
Okay.
Apparently, the players and the students felt very strongly.
Sure, sure.
Things that he should have done that he didn't do.
But
now, having said that, some of the stories that I've heard, it's not just in the recent past, it's been ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that's a little intriguing.
Yes, it's certainly an interesting situation. To me, it seems like a throwback to kind of the late 60s, about 10 years after you were in college. A lot of student-athlete activism going on in the late 60s, early 70s, which is what I thought of when the University of Missouri thing happened. I think it's interesting that some athletes are again thinking about using their position for political ends or for civil rights ends or for things they think are important, which I think athletes have not always done and, of course, don't have to do, but it's interesting that it's happening again, I think.
And I'm not so sure that it will continue, even grow.
It certainly was very unusual and is not the normal situation, what goes on in most college campuses with the student-athletes, to be sure. I think we're about an hour and 12 minutes now, which is a good length of time to be talking. I'm sure your voice is probably tired. Any last wrap-up comments or thoughts before we hit the stop button?
I can't think of any.
Okay.
Anticipating we'll be talking again.
All right. I'm going to stop the recording for now. Let's see.